this episode, we get to interview the wonderful Billy Harrigan. Billy is the owner and director of Birth Trauma Ontario, which provides education and training for maternity providers and allied birth professionals in trauma-informed care, as well as providing information and support for parents and loved ones that are dealing with birth-related trauma or birthing after trauma. Billy is a traditional birth companion, a certified birth and postpartum doula and childbirth educator, among many other things. We delve into some deep topics in this episode. What is trauma-informed care? How one-third of women experience trauma following birth? The importance of language? And we discuss the skill of affective empathy and how this is key to gain an emotional resonance with another person. How effective empathy changes outcomes, improves client trust, and how it reduces burnout in clinicians and improves overall job satisfaction. I think you'll find this episode both challenging and game-changing. And as Billy says, it's time to start equipping women with the tools they need. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favorite podcast host. So here we are, and I will start us and introduce us because I don't want to go too much over time for either of you. I know you're busy people, and Rachel has a date with her bed for bedtime.
Actually, I do too. I'm going to go back to bed and have a nap.
Oh, Billy, that's just such a sensible idea. Brilliant.
Isn't it though?
It is. I love a little nap. Oh, a nana nap. Such a treat. Great. It is an absolute pleasure to have you here in the cauldron with us, Billy. Thank you so much for joining us on your wintry, almost spring-like day. I'm in full spring and Rachel is just sweltering in the rains and the heat and the mold, but we are all in the cauldron together to find out more about the work that you are doing, which is incredibly important work, Billy, and something that we have touched upon quite a bit in the podcast and is sort of like a red thread theme that does run through, because we know that there is a huge amount of trauma that can come from birth and birth practices, both within the families and the mums that we work with, but also in healthcare professionals as well. And so it's really exciting to have you on and to talk a little bit more deeply about this kind of trauma and trauma-informed care that you specialise in.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
Billy, do you want to just tell us a little bit about who you are and what you're doing and how you ended up doing what you're doing?
Oh, goodness. I would say it started with my first baby. That was a traumatic shit show that, I think, you know, kind of the norm in how women tend to have their first babies induced, because I'm more of a crock pot than a microwave. So I carry my babies longer, but, you know, that doesn't fit within the obstetrical mold. And it was just basically horrific from beginning to end. And I ended up with some pretty serious PTSD and a baby that I brought home after 8 days that they told me was mine. And she looked like my husband. So, okay, I took this child home and had to figure out what to do after that. Mm. And I often say now, if they just treated me nicely, I wouldn't be this colossal pain in the arse I am now.
I think that's probably true for most of us.
So from there, it was just figuring out what discovering the profound difference between what research says or common knowledge or wisdom says about safe birthing and safe birth practices and obstetrics, and how the two are so entirely incompatible at times. and going on to have much simpler births called outside the system because I didn't use regulated services after that. And eventually started serving in the capacity of a traditional birth attendant myself. And then studying and writing about birth-related trauma and trauma-informed practices. And I set up with a colleague many years ago, Birth Trauma Ontario, and a colleague moved on. And so I run that organization, and it's a support for women who have had a traumatic birth to help them connect to each other for peer support, to find trauma-informed practitioners for therapeutic healing, and to teach the skills of trauma-informed care to practitioners who are interested.
Great. Mm. I'd like to just ask you probably a question you're asked all the time, and just for clarifying purposes, is that a word? Yes. Clarification. That's the one.
I think it is a word.
Wow, I've actually got a real word for once. Blimey. Here we go. Brilliant. I wonder if I can just ask about if you could explain to the audience a bit more about what is trauma-informed? What does it really mean when we get down to the nuts and bolts? Because we hear this word used.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's actually becoming a bit of a buzzword where folks are saying I'm trauma-informed without actually knowing what it is.
Yeah.
When in fact, mm-hmm. it is a very specific skill set. You know, it's a skill set that you need to learn. And I say it's like a universal precaution. You need to know how to wash your hands and put on gloves if you're going to be touching somebody's bodily fluids. You should, if you're a practitioner, you should have CPR. And I think if anybody is going to be working with birthing families, it's a skill set that is as life-saving as knowing CPR.
Yeah.
Because one of the consequences of trauma is suicide. And in many resource-rich settings, the leading cause of postpartum death is suicide, and it's highly correlated to trauma.
Yeah.
And it also impacts the entire family. It impacts the child growing up. It exposes the baby and the child to adverse childhood experiences, and that primes them for poor health outcomes throughout their lifetime. So it's a cascade of consequences, and it's really a very simple skill set. And perhaps the foundation of trauma-informed care is to not look at a client or a patient or whoever you're working with and to say what's wrong with you, but to look at them with the perspective of what happened to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm.
I think that's incredibly important and a really underknown fact. And I think, you know, there isn't a lot of knowledge behind this, and it seems to be an incredibly shocking statistic that it doesn't feel to me that this is discussed enough within midwifery education or care working within this. And yet this is something that needs to be highlighted and needs to be taken seriously. Like you say, it's a fundamental, or it should be a fundamental practice that we are trained as healthcare professionals working with women who are pregnant and have given birth to have this skill set.
And it's really interesting, isn't it? Because we've got, you know, we have mandatory training in hemorrhage, which is another maternal death issue.
Yeah.
So the other things, the physical causes of maternal death are highlighted, and we have mandatory training, and we have to, you know, be competent in managing them. And nobody actually talks about mental health and suicide, which is also in Australia, it's, you know, one of the leading causes of maternal death next to heart disease. And yet we don't have training on that. It's not mandatory training on trauma-informed care. It's interesting.
I'm finding there's a great deal of resistance to it. You know, as we know, maternity services are cultural. And within that culture, it's the idea that their services are coming from a place of extreme beneficence, as they're doing the client wonderful favors by taking care of them. And I've even stopped calling it prenatal care. I call it maternity services now, because there's often very little care involved. It's a series of routines and rituals. But there's tremendous resistance within the industry to look at this and say, well, one in three of our clients emerges having had a traumatic experience, and up to one in eight end up with postpartum PTSD. Mm-hmm. And the leading cause, not always, but the leading cause is the behavior of the clinician. So there's tremendous resistance to looking at this and examining the fact that, as we know, even getting practitioners to understand what disrespectful care actually is. You know, that's what the WHO is calling it now, is disrespectful care. Other places call it obstetric violence. But to even look at that and say, well, the fact that many clinicians, and that could be, you know, obstetricians, nurses, midwives, anesthesiologists, whoever is providing a clinical service, they don't recognize what disrespectful care is. So having a plus size client and who's having a challenging labor, to say to them, well, if you didn't eat so many Twinkies, you wouldn't be having this difficulty. And when we think of women who have a background of trauma, trauma influences behaviors in coping strategies, management strategies. There's higher rates of substance use. There's higher rates of health consequences. And yet these are exactly the people who are more likely to be mistreated. Yeah. So if they have someone with a background of trauma, will have more likely to have poorer socioeconomic outcomes. And that will place them at higher risk for abuse within the maternity services. They may have more health consequences, more complex pregnancies. That places them at more risk for mistreatment and abuse within maternity services. So exactly that client who needs more care, more understanding, is exactly the client who's most likely to be mistreated.
That's absolutely right. And it's, I have a passion within breastfeeding, but I have also had other areas of my career. I've been working with women who have drug and alcohol issues during pregnancy and severe mental health problems. And you're absolutely right. They often go hand in hand, that trauma, the circumstances, you know, they all lead to this area of these women who are needing so much more support. And yet often the women that I found in my own personal practice in different hospitals, there was almost a fear from the midwives or a fear from the obstetricians of, I don't know how to deal with this woman and her issues, so to speak, or because she doesn't fit the mold of normal. And then there wasn't really the interest of wanting to find out more and why. It was just, Katie, you need to see this woman. She's admitted she's taking these drugs. Or, Katie, you need to come and deal with this because we can't deal with this. She's your client. And it was a real pushing away. So it almost feels like there's a fear from the health professional and a lack of interest to want to delve deeper into this, because it is not an easy area and it's complex, highly complex. But it's also fascinating, because what you learn from working with women with really difficult complexities in their life, you take those parts into working with every other woman within your care. And I think that's something that we should and must all learn. Like Rachel says, we're taught these other obstetric emergencies. This isn't an obstetric emergency that we're seeing.
Absolutely it is. Clients who come with a disadvantaged background, perhaps they had an abusive childhood, perhaps they were the victims of childhood sexual abuse or trafficking or any of these other horrible, but sadly not uncommon backgrounds. By the time they come to their maternity experience, they've gone through a lot. And what is the rituals of maternity services involves a lot of penetrating their genitals, expecting them to be compliant, to lie down, to be good little girls, because good little girls love their babies. And if they aren't being a good little girl, maybe they don't love their baby, and maybe they need to be reported to the authorities. I did have a woman sitting in my office that was told she would wanted to decline the 20-week anatomy scan. And the obstetrician said, well, if you don't care about your baby, we may have to bring in people who do care about your baby.
Oh, God.
This happens all the time. And yet women who survive these earlier experiences, they survived.
Yeah.
They survived. Mm. And whatever it is they did to survive, maybe whatever kinds of relationships they created, however they learned to interact with other people, it might look dysfunctional to somebody who didn't survive them. And they might be, you know, the one who did not have to survive these experiences are looking at these supposedly dysfunctional behaviors. And I'm looking at them thinking, by golly, you survived. You did it. And that's an approach that acknowledges that they have the ability to survive and to make decisions. It looks dysfunctional to somebody else, but it's not to them. They kept them alive and got them to where they are.
Yeah. God, mm-hmm. Absolutely. You're so right, Billy, in that it is, there's an absolute strength that I have seen with these women as well. And you're right. It looks dysfunctional because it doesn't fit the norm of the mold. And because we are fearful as humans of what isn't in the norm of our frameworks, there, the other thing I think that comes with that is that when you've had to survive and you're not thriving, you are surviving through life. And whether that's from taking drugs to help numb pain, associating with certain groups that are the only ones you've got because your family are not safe to be with, or whatever the circumstances, there is a huge amount of lack of trust within often the health service, police service, all of these services that we're offering. And for me, what I found was this was often the first time when perhaps this woman felt compelled that she had to come and see a midwife. She couldn't deal with it in her own way because there was someone else to think about in terms of the baby. And this was almost like a compelling to come. But what I think is so important is you've got someone who is taking a huge step out of their comfort zone to have to try and trust the healthcare professionals who perhaps have dismissed them, perhaps have blamed them, perhaps have said incredibly horrendous things, which we have heard been repeated to us. But at this point in time, they feel they need to access help. And if they get help and are seen by a midwife or an obstetrician who is dismissive and blaming and doesn't feel like a trustworthy source, we will lose them so quickly. And it is so important to be able to listen to their story and just take away that judgment as well, because we don't know what has led someone to where they are. And I think that knowledge is vital in our care for all women.
One of the a primary reason why many women will not seek help is the threat of child services being called on them. Mm. So they don't seek postnatal care, they often won't seek antenatal care. And I call that, it's actually one of the tactics of terror to do something as an example, to make an example out of a family. And that's a terror tactic so that other families or other people won't break the rules. And when one maternity service provider calls family services on a client who isn't making choices that the service provider approves of and calls family services, it's a message to everybody else, get in line and behave. Mm. But what it does is it just drives them away and they don't get help that they could benefit from. I mean, there are some things that happens in maternity services that are quite beneficial. It's really great to get your infections treated. That's a good one. That one is a proven benefit. I mean, the anatomy scan, not so much, but you know.
I think there's a misunderstanding about child safety, isn't there? You know, there's not having an ultrasound scan or having a VBAC at home without a medical practitioner is not a child safety issue. but people are interpreting, you know, they're using the mandatory reporting to punish women who are making decisions that aren't aligned with the cultural norms. So, you know, I don't know how you stop that, because, you know, the people doing it genuinely think that it's a child safety issue often, when it's not. It's a punishment to the woman for making a decision that people aren't happy with.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together.
That's exactly what it is. Yes. She was a bad girl. And I think regulated services, they tend to miss the importance of peer support. Because I don't work in regulated services, I help clients connect to peers. Peer support is transformative for many people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not always the professional that needs to be called in. Getting together with another family and figuring out how to cook food on a budget is transformative. Hanging out with other families that have learned more gentle parenting, or to normalize the fact that babies don't sleep and to be with one another when they're breastfeeding. So peer support is huge. To be on the phone to say, I've had another flashback. Yeah. This really sucks. Yeah, it really sucks. It's terrible. And to be talking to somebody. Peer support for the journey through their pregnancies and into parenthood and recovery and developing resilience is very underutilized. I mean, you don't make money off of peer support.
Mm. And yet peer support will be there for years and years and years afterwards. You know, those connections that families make will be ongoing. The professionals there for that small amount of time, you know, for that particular purpose.
Yeah. Mm. God, that's so important. And we see peer support having been used and researched upon quite extensively in the neonatal unit. And it's just wonderful to read the positive outcomes and there's certain hospitals in the US in particular that employ their peer supporters in the neonatal units, and because they see the value. And yeah, I'm just sort of having these moments now going, wow, God, we're missing a trick. You're quite right. And Rachel, yes, that longevity of it is just...
And mentors who have, you know, come out the other side of trauma and figured out how to do some newer life skills. And I call it the resilience threshold, up to increase the resilience threshold that allows them to experience more adversity and still emerge intact.
And I mean, we see that if we look at drug and alcohol services in particular, take it away from maternity services, often the people who are working within those services have gone through that trauma, that drug use themselves, and come out the other side and then have focused their life into working and supporting other people within that field. Mm. And to think that we could have that within maternity services, wow, that's just making my mind go, oh my God, that would just be so incredible. Why have I never comprehended, you know, having something that's so, it's so simple and yet so powerful.
Mm.
I'd love to know a bit more about how the course that you've written and developed, really impressive, how this is working and how you've been going with this for healthcare professionals and for mums.
Well, it was offered, but has been discontinued by its host. So it's back in my hands to be reformatted. What I've found, though, is that the interest from actual healthcare professionals is quite low. There's a feeling within the culture of healthcare practitioners that they are trauma-informed. The results of their services would suggest otherwise, when 1 in 3 of their clients are traumatized and 1 in 8 end up with PTSD. So the evidence points to the fact that no, they are not trauma-informed, but there's very little interest. So it's time to find out who does want to be trauma-informed in working with families. The doulas do. They want to be trauma-informed. Mm-hmm. They see what happens. They're witnesses to what happens to their clients. And I think there's a move to more traditional birth attendants that would like to work with families in a different way, a non-medicalized way. And I think they're very interested in it. And I think that families themselves need to learn now. They need to learn why they were susceptible to trauma. There are certain risk factors. Yes, if the event is traumatic enough, it will overwhelm anybody if it's big enough. But there are pre-existing risk factors that increase the potential for somebody to be traumatized by a smaller event. Now, only the individual can decide whether it was traumatic or not, because only that individual had their resources overwhelmed. Only that individual is the one who is experiencing the physical changes in their brain.
Mm-hmm.
Trauma is much like a brain injury because there are changes within the limbic system, physical and structural changes. And perhaps the physiology of their brain was more at risk. They may have been exceptionally low in vitamin D, which is neuroprotective. They may have been very low in omega-3 DHA, again, very neuroprotective. Their magnesium stores might have been too low to protect their brain. So there are also nutritional risk factors that makes their brain more susceptible to a traumatic injury from a traumatic event. So this is the good, important stuff to teach parents themselves.
God, to prepare them.
And so I would like to spend more time talking to parents. If healthcare professionals are resistant to learning this, so be it. Whatever. you can't teach a rock to sing. So if they're not interested, let's find out who's interested. The parents, they need to learn.
Exactly.
If they're coming from a background with sexual assault, they may not want to access regulated maternity services.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps they need a traditional birth attendant or their grandmother or their aunties to help them through their labor and their birth, because that might not be a safe place. It's okay to teach this to them. It's okay to say you don't have to sign up for the services that they're offering.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. So I would like to talk to them. I would like to talk to the doulas so that the doulas can help teach their clients what the risk factors are and how they can start approaching their resilience threshold. It might involve getting some DHA into them. It might involve separating from toxic relationships. It might be not signing up for a certain practitioner who thinks the weekly vaginal exam starting at 35 weeks is the way to go.
God. So, just, it still flabbergasts me that can even happen and isn't stopped by another practitioner.
Is that, that's a US thing? Is that a Canadian thing too?
This, yeah, it's a North American
regular
thing.
Vaginal examinations in pregnancy.
It was still happening in Australia when I was first there.
What?
I can remember. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So it had never happened in the UK. I'd never seen that. But when I came to Australia, I was quite flabbergasted and overwhelmed. And yeah.
I've never seen that. And, you know, it really annoys me when people talk about, you know, it's really important to know if somebody has had a history of sexual abuse, because then, you know, you can do all these things around vaginal examinations. Hang on a minute. You don't know if a woman's had a history of sexual abuse. She might not want to tell you that. And why should she have to tell you that in order to not have you putting your fingers in her unnecessarily and treating her respectfully? It drives me like nuts.
Absolutely.
Oh, there is no need. There is no need to be putting your fingers in a woman antenatally. There's none. Like, what is the point of that?
One point is to build in sexual submission so that during labor, it's much easier to penetrate her for charting purposes. I did have a client that came to me because of a history of sexual assault, and her midwife felt that it was fairly worthwhile and important to start vaginal exams in pregnancy to get her used to them so that it would be easier in labor. God.
Wow. And if that practitioner has done it with that, with one woman, it's happening with all of their clients. Mm-hmm. Oh dear God. Sometimes I just think we've got so flipping far to go, but this is what it's about. It's about raising awareness as well. And also about saying that if you are the midwife, because often if it's a male obstetrician, they have to have a chaperone in with them. And so they will call on the midwife. And for me, that's when we have the opportunity to stand up and say no and act as the advocate for this woman and to know that there is no need for this to be occurring or happening. And even if the midwife doesn't feel confident, but knows that this practice is happening, then she has the opportunity to discuss this privately with the woman, to empower the woman to also say no or speak on her behalf and give the woman the choice, because they are just put in this submission position, which is incredibly frightening for any of us. Even if we wouldn't describe it as frightening, it's invasive, and we feel not inferior, but we feel in this submission position. We don't feel in a position of strength. We often have this sort of white coat syndrome, most of us anyway. We just go into this mode of, oh God, there's a doctor, I've forgotten what I've got to say and I can't answer back. But even more so when we're exposing ourselves. And, you know, I don't know any woman that's going to stick her hand up and go, hey, do you really enjoy your regular pap smear? I mean, it's not exactly the highlight of your calendar. You're not getting out the champagne on that the night before going, woohoo, guess what I've got tomorrow? You know, even if no one's come into that with no other history, it's not a pleasant thing. We don't look forward to it. Why on earth are we doing this to women? Why are we allowed to ignore all of this research that shows that such a high proportion of women have had some kind of sexual assault from childhood or early adulthood? And even if the women haven't experienced this, why are we allowed to do this to them? It is just wrong when there is no medical evidence.
Well, you could argue it is sexual assault. There is no evidence for doing it. You're not getting any information that's helpful. So why are you doing it?
Yes.
It's the culture of disempowerment. From the very first visit, where the midwifery clinic says, we won't take you until you have a dating ultrasound, because we won't trust that you know when you conceived.
How could we know? We're just women.
We won't take you without the dating ultrasound. So from that very first visit, the woman is stupid. We can't trust you. And from then on, it's month after month of disempowerment. Yeah. That you might have some hidden disease, but you don't know about it. And we have to check this and we have to check that. And now it's 39 weeks and we're going to give you your routine stretch and sweep, because we don't want you going overdue. And we'll just check you. And all of this checking is, it's and it builds in sexual submission. So it's very easy by the time she's in labor to do pretty much anything to her.
And I mean, that with the language that we use and the threatening language that is played off as normal, but the wording, you know, it's, that's the thing. It's almost like women can feel empowered or in have knowledge, but you have one doctor say, this could potentially put your baby's life at risk if you don't let me do an ARM, artificial rupture of membranes. It's so easy to manipulate someone in a vulnerable position.
Oh, the dead baby threat. That's our favorite. When I'm working with clients, I always ask if they've had regulated services, I'll ask them if they've got the dead baby threat. And if they get to maybe 36 weeks or so without it, it's like, ooh, you've got a good one. You haven't had the dead baby threat yet.
Well, that research that we did into respectful maternity care, and you know, we actually, one of the questions that we asked was, describe what was traumatic about your care. And you know, you hear about the dead baby card; it's a thing. But I actually didn't think it would come up in the data, and it did. Women were quite clearly saying, I was threatened that my baby would die if I didn't do X, Y, Z. You know, they were literally getting the dead baby threat. You know, this thing that we've heard about that you go, no, nobody's doing that. This is what these women were telling us, that they were threatened with, your baby's going to die or you will kill your baby. You know, some women were being told, if you don't do this, you will kill your baby.
How do you stand up to that when you're in labor?
Well, you go along with it because, you know, as Billy was saying, you've been groomed all the way through your pregnancy to trust these people, that they know better than you, that they, you know, are so concerned about the safety of your baby that, you know, they know more about it than you do. So it's, and then you're in a vulnerable position in labor and birth, and these are the people who are going to save your baby.
Exactly.
Then, you know, it's not often until afterwards when women come out the other side and just try and work out what the hell happened, that they start to unpick and see a little bit more clearly what happened.
And women are going into survival mode. There was a hospital here that was, there was quite a bit of advocacy to tell them to clean up their act and for the culture to get a little more client friendly. So in order to address that, they announced that they were going to have an exit interview so that the women could fill out a survey. How was your services as they depart and take their babies home? And so I wrote to them to say, well, that's going to be absolutely useless information, because if you've traumatized and threatened this mother, she is in survival mode and she is going to pick up her baby and get as far away from you as possible. And in order, until she's safe and her baby is safe, she's going to say, it was wonderful. You were just the most magnificent people. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Because she's going to survive. She's going to get her baby away from you. So if you really want to find out how you did, talk to her in 9 months when she knows she's safe.
Absolutely.
I don't think they received that very well.
Did it make a change? Did they?
No.
I was hoping you were going to give me a great answer, Billy. I mean, I had to ask.
No, I mean, it would have achieved the purpose that they set it out for. It would that everybody who exits had a glorious experience. So they don't know what the community has a problem with. So it would have achieved their goal.
A lot of hospitals have implemented the debrief, haven't they? So they kind of, during a labor and birth process, they'll decide there'll be certain flags for offering a woman a debrief. And it's usually, you know, around a physical trauma, you know, so a woman who has what looks like a normal spontaneous birth without any trauma, physical trauma, won't get this debrief. But then they go, okay, this woman had a hemorrhage or this woman had an emergency cesarean, she can have a debrief. And then the women go in and it seems to be more about justifying what was done than actually listening to her and asking her what was done and how it felt. And it's almost like this, I don't know, I could be a bit cynical and say it's a kind of back covering exercise, but it doesn't seem to be, you know, what I would call a debrief. Or
hospitals here have a service called patient relations. So if somebody has a complaint, they call up patient relations. Patient relations works for the hospital. So their role, although they're there to help the patient have a better experience, they're a hospital employee. That means their dual role, and perhaps their primary role, is to ensure this doesn't escalate to litigation. Mm. They need to manage the situation, and they manage it with very kind words. The ones I've spoken with were lovely, lovely people, but the goal is to ensure that the patient is placated and nothing changes, because this can't escalate to litigation.
Yeah.
So it's a very frustrating experience for people who have had a bad experience, the dead baby threat, the coercion, lying even. There are very few recourses. Patient relations will listen to them, but not much changes. They can complain to various regulatory bodies, but coercion, it's a soft area. It's very hard to prove coercion. So
yeah,
it really doesn't ever go anywhere. So that's why I think it's very important to talk about the reality. What is the actual situation in the culture of maternity services? Let's stop gaslighting women. Let's stop gaslighting them, saying, oh, they're going to save you, it's going to be wonderful, they really care. Some do, but the culture itself is fairly abusive. So if we tell them the truth and prepare them, if you still choose to go there, if you still choose to do that, let's work on your resilience threshold so that you have more skills, you have more tools to manage it and to recover from it if you still choose to do that. Let's also say you have options. You don't have to if you don't want to. So I think it's time we really do need to tell women the truth. There's just a lot of gaslighting. Mm. Just go to the hospital. It'll be so great. It might be, but it might not. One third of the time, it's just outright traumatic. And traumatic is not disappointing. It's not difficult. It's not upsetting. A traumatic experience comes with threat to life. It comes with helplessness. It's not just, well, that sucked. It's a very distinct, identifiable experience. And so one third come out of there with feeling like their lives were threatened or their baby's lives were threatened, extreme helplessness, often violation of their consent, their culture, their bodies, their sexuality. And that's one third is a horrific number. Here in Canada, one third have a traumatic experience. About 1 in 8 end up with postpartum PTSD. 1 in 3 end up with postpartum depression and or anxiety. 1 in 10 have thoughts of self-harm in the first year. If I had results anywhere close to that, I'd be in jail. But this is the norm. So I like that we're talking openly and we can just give up the gaslighting. It's not all roses and farting unicorns. It is a tough culture for women to go into to have a baby. And if they choose to do that, let's equip them so that they can manage the situation and they can come out with better skills to recover if it was traumatic. And yes, doulas are key in that too, in helping with that. Mm. But the doulas are not in the hospitals right now because the world's in a bit of a dumpster fire.
Absolutely.
What are the options? So most of our listeners are not Canadian. Tell us a little bit about what the options are in Canada for birth. How is it set up?
Well, the regulated services include either physician or registered midwife. And here in Canada, midwifery was deemed an illegal practice from before Confederation. The fledgling Canadian Medical Association, all male, went to the brand new Parliament of Upper Canada, that was a province at the time, to say they wanted the practice of midwifery illegal so that they could build their medical practice. And so the male politicians thought that was a grand idea. And Canada was the only country in the world where the practice of midwifery was deemed illegal. And it wasn't until 1993, here in the province I live in, where it was first decriminalized. So, of course, there's always been midwives. And that's what the oldest or second oldest profession in the world. I guess. So there's always been midwives, but there was some pretty great research done in 1987. It was called the Midwifery Task Force. And they were taking a look at how women across Canada had babies before they all went to the hospital. And for the most part, they stayed home. And there was a neighbor who had four or five babies. So she was the most experienced person in the neighborhood. And she came over and they had a birth. And that neighbor was the neighborhood community midwife for about four or five babies. And then she moved on and the next neighbor became the community midwife. Now, these women, these neighbors, had no training in hemorrhage control, no training in neonatal resuscitation, no training in breech or twins. And yet the outcomes of these friendly neighborly births were 4 to 10 times better than anything happening in a hospital with a physician. So as it turns out, being nice happens to really improve outcomes.
What do you know? Who'd have thunk it?
So that's an option. You can still use your physiology in your own home. Your neighbors can still come and be with you. You can still have aunties and grandmas. It's an option. You can go to a hospital, but you don't have to. You can have a midwife come to your home, a regulated midwife, if you meet all of the criteria. And the criteria is very, very strict. And then you have to continue to meet some pretty strict criteria at home as well, including the time you're allowed in each of the supposed stages, inverted commas. Your baby can't move its bowels before it's born, or it's an ambulance ride to the hospital. There's just lots of parameters, but we can still just have babies. We can still take care of each other. And that's kind of how I had mine. We just took care of each other.
So is that a publicly funded system or is that privately funded?
Publicly.
Okay.
Universal healthcare. So all our tax money pays for hospital births and regulated midwives.
Billy, can I ask, and it's going back to what you were talking about in terms of let's stop gaslighting women. Let's have this information out there. Let's have this conversation with everyone. Obviously, I work in this world, but I surround myself with, you know, women who are at baby having age. And I suppose what I'm trying to ask is, I think there are a lot of women out there who don't want to know. And how do we get this message out without frightening people? Because they're scary numbers that we've been talking about here. And there are a lot of women who, it's almost like ignorance is bliss. There's a lot of women who make that absolute choice that I'm going to read one book, or I'm not going to read anything, or I found this one blog that I really like, or whatever resonates with them. But this stuff is just not in their field of vision, and they don't want it to mask, to cloud, whatever, or to put fear into them whilst they're pregnant.
The fear is already there. That's part of the conditioning and the programming. From the time we are little girls and we play with our baby dolls that come with their plastic baby bottles that condition us to formula feeding, the conditioning for fear is already there. And then women tell horror stories about their births. And as soon as a woman sees a pregnant woman, they're triggered and they tell a horror story. But I said, the reason they're telling horror stories is because their births were horrible. If women stopped having horrible births, they wouldn't be telling horror stories. When they sit around and they're, I was at a baby shower recently, and the older women, after the presents had been opened, they all started relaying their births. And this apparently, I was told by a family member, this was a common experience. It was their trauma bonding. They were trauma bonded to each other through their really horrible births and trauma bonded to the hospital. And so this is the story that they tell over and over, and they're so grateful that they could get to the hospital where these terrible things happened, because they're obviously told it's their faulty bodies and birth is very, very dangerous. So women are afraid anyway, and all they hear for the most part are horror stories. But no, they're not connecting the dots that they were horrible because of the circumstances around them, not the birth itself. Rarely is it the birth itself. And so they're already in a state of fear They've already been programmed to trauma bonding, to the place where these terrible things happen. So what happens when somebody tells a great birth story? It's like the unicorn came out of the woods and a really beautiful birth story. But to further that along, why was it beautiful? How did that happen? What choices did they make? Who did they invite? What trauma bonding did they take a really good look at and separate from? So reaching women with good stories, and there are a lot of them, but how did it happen? It happened through making new choices. I started a group for people that are interested in out-of-system birthing, and a pet project I have is called Why I Left. Because we don't just leave something, we go to something. So the story, it's stories of women, why they left regulated services and what their outcomes were. So why did they leave? What did they go to? So that there's kind of an anchor. You don't just leave, you go to something. And so normalizing these great births and what it took to get there, how to break up from the trauma bonding, how to separate from the family history of, oh, all the women in our family have terrible births. Well, maybe you don't. Maybe you just have terrible care providers.
Women don't think there's value in normal, in brackets, you know, birth where there isn't trauma. When I did my PhD, I specifically targeted women who had had physiological birth because that's what I wanted to know about. I wanted to know the experience of physiological birth. And it was really interesting because most of the women were kind of surprised they were being included in research. And quite a few of them actually said, well, I haven't really got a story. What do you want me to tell you? Because I haven't really got a birth story. It was really interesting because their birth stories weren't, you know, dramatic and, you know, near death experiences being rushed to theater. They were, you know, just in quotes, physiological births. And these women couldn't understand why these stories would be valuable. And I think there's a lot of that. Women are almost, one, don't see the value or don't want to upset other women by saying, well, actually, my birth was really great. It was actually just pretty straightforward and, you know, not much happened in terms of complication. And I had this amazing baby at the end of it. It's not something that women feel able to share. And that trauma bonding, you know, there is this, when you get women talking about their birth stories, it's almost like war stories, isn't it? Or fishing stories. It becomes this, you know, my experience was more traumatic than yours because, oh my God, you should have seen what happened to me. And it's like this spiral. And where are these stories about, you know, just the bog standard normal birth where babies just are born?
Well, newspapers are not sold on the nice things that happened that day.
That's true.
And I think, you know, there is also a place for us to talk about the fact that for some women, it is really important that they do feel safe within the hospital. So, for example, you know, in a service, and that brings me back to what you said about it's just about kindness, really, at the end of the day. And so for a lot of women, it will feel safer for whatever reason for them to be within the medical system, perhaps to have a more medicalized, managed birth for whatever reason, or they need to. And I think it's important that we talk about those women who don't have necessarily the opportunity to come out of that traditional system. But what is so important, and, you know, I go back to, again, my experiences, but we had women who did need to go through this system. But at the end of the day, it was always about the type of support they received from the midwives caring for them, from the obstetric team, from the team I was able to work with. That was kindness and listening. And even if they had to have the planned cesarean or the induction or whatever it was for mental health reasons or for whatever, it was about listening to what was safest and best for them, hearing their story and actually working out a plan that felt right for them and continuing with that type of approach into the postnatal period. And those women came out with a more positive outlook. And it wasn't the home birth and it wasn't the whatever, it was very medicalized, but they felt safe, listened to, and not traumatized.
And the skill you're talking about is affective empathy. So in medical training, most practitioners are taught to have cognitive empathy. which is to cognitively say, oh dear, you know, that sounds challenging, or, you know, I guess we'll have to look at that, to more along the lines of sympathy. But that's not anything that improves outcomes. Yeah. Affective empathy is gaining an emotional resonance with the other person, an emotional resonance that says, you're kind of, you can feel that. Yes. Yes. That feels devastating. That feels scary. I can really. So affective empathy changes outcomes. It improves a client. Well, the word that's used in literature is compliance, client compliance, or they participate. Let's use some better language. They participate in the suggestions and the care strategies. So they're more willing to participate in it because they felt that the clinician understood them. Now, the other great thing about affective empathy is it reduces burnout in the clinician, significantly reduces burnout. It improves clinical accuracy and improves overall satisfaction with the job they have. So affective empathy is a game changer for both parties, the clinician and the client.
Wow. So need mandatory training on that. Mm.
There should be, yeah.
Affective empathy, absolutely. Oh my gosh, that's just brilliant.
It's huge.
That needs to go into the curriculum of every care provider, anybody who works with people.
It even reduces litigation. So a practitioner, the most sued practitioners on the planet are obstetricians.
One case would pay to reduce one case of litigation would pay for their entire staff to be trained.
Just on that. And so a client can go into a hospital and have the most medicalized experience. If they're surrounded by people who have the skill of affective empathy, they're going to come out of that feeling cared for, nurtured, and ready for the parenting journey ahead of them.
Oh my goodness, Billy. Just so many.
Don't say shall nuggets. I say it?
Awesome nuggets. But there were.
Oh, you nuggeted that just in there. Oh,
like, yeah, I did nugget that in. I was like, I'm going to have to stop. It's too many nuggets going on each episode now, but I can't help it when I speak to people like you and, you know, we get this information, these little, they're nuggets, for God's sake, they're nuggets of one, information, but two, hope. For me, I find there is still hope because sometimes it can feel hopeless as a practitioner looking at the statistics and thinking, how do I make change? And so having this on a wider discussion really helps. And that for me has been so brilliant.
Thank you. There is hope. These are trauma-informed care are simple skills. And it's easy to learn. It's easy to practice. It reduces burnout in clinicians. It improves accuracy. Clients have a better experience. They're more equipped for the journey ahead. What I'm up against in training and offering this education is just resistance to learning it. So when we figure out how to get over that hump, we'll be on our way.
Is there any other golden nuggets you would like to leave us with, Billy, to, like, if you've got a couple of points that you want to sum up what you've discussed today or a message you want to send out to our listeners?
Birth doesn't ever have to be traumatic. It doesn't matter whether it's medicalized. It doesn't matter if it's an emergency. It doesn't matter what your health conditions are. It doesn't ever have to be traumatic. It's just having a baby. You know, it happens all the time. It's just having a baby. So learning simple skills of how to increase resilience threshold, and that might be something as simple as getting some DHA into your diet, eating some fish or taking a capsule. It might be something as simple as getting some more magnesium to improve the structure and function of your brain. It can also be teaching your family how to be more compassionate. It can be changing who your relationships are and not being afraid to dump a practitioner who is offensive. Dump them. Go somewhere else. Birth doesn't ever have to be traumatic.
Thank you, Billy.
Thank you. Thank you for having
me. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
And I just also have to say thank you. Billy was a critical reader for my book, and I really enjoyed our interactions around Billy's responses to my chapters, because they were, it was always interesting. She put me in my place a few times, which was great.
Oops.
Well done, Billy. Goodness.
Well, it wasn't meant to be like that. I enjoyed it so much. Your book is a treasure.
No, it was great, because every time I got feedback, you sent me off thinking about other things. And like, it was a pleasure to have you doing that.
Oh, thank you. It was a delight. Your book is a treasure. Oh my gosh. I think it should be mandatory reading for all kinds of people. It's extraordinary. Yes, it's extraordinary. Thank you for writing it.
We hope you found this episode insightful and thought-provoking, just as we did interviewing Billy. For more information on the services Billy offers, of course, go to our links. And as always, we are loving hearing what you think of the episodes, how you're finding them, suggestions for further episodes. So please keep those coming. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. We love reading them, but it also helps to get the message out. And don't be shy. Share our Instagram with anyone you can think of, because who wouldn't love to listen to the Midwife's Cauldron? Go on, bring them into the cauldron too. So we leave you with this episode, but of course, there's always bloopers. See you next time. Can you start from disadvantage again? I'm so sorry. That's me going, I don't know whether my video still works or whether you can hear me, but the internet.
I'm just pleased it's not me.
This is what Rachel gets all the time, is me going, the hand stop or the bang. I don't know which one works. Like, how much internet have you got? Have you got video still, or do you just have my voice going, stop, stop?
I have to repeat everything.
Okay, well, there goes my brain fart, so.
Oh, no, I'm so sorry, Billy. No, it just went, that's all we got. Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, the Fundamentals, has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies, and some pretty tough, at times, quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created the Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's POD10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.